It is my pleasure to introduce Sarah Hudson DeSalle, pharmacy manager at the Wexner Medical Center and James Cancer Hospital at the. I'm surprised that's not capital. Is that okay? All right. At the Ohio State, because I know if I don't say the, I'm in big trouble. At the Ohio State University.
Marketing people might come after
you. Never know. Talking to us about communication with payers, relationships, and resources.
Good afternoon. I hope we aren't still in any in that food coma. Afternoons do have a tendency to have that kind of occur. So thank you for joining me. I'm Sarah Hudson DeSalle. I'm a pharmacy manager at the James and Ohio State Wexner Medical Center. We're going to talk today about the immuno-oncology agents, and specifically around a lot with our payers, uses, understanding how to communicate with our payers, and most importantly, how do you make sure that you ensure that you're going to get paid for these agents. So I have a lot of material that I'm going to cover today, so some of these slides I'm going to go through really quickly. I have nothing to disclose. I do plan to speak about off-label indications for both atezolizumab, nivolumab, and pembrolizumab. To kind of set the stage, I really thought it was important to kind of talk about the model of my practice at the James and my team. We have kind of two arms, and the reimbursement specialists are the folks that kind of handle and work with our IO agents. These folks, I also have a group of folks that we do medication access for our patients, but for the purpose of this discussion, we're going to talk about the reimbursement specialists and my role at the James. There are currently three PD-1 agents that are on the market, Keytruda, pembrolizumab, nivolumab, and atezolizumab. The first agent on the market was pembrolizumab, which is Keytruda that is produced by Merck. I'm not going to go through all these indications. I do not have the orphan drug indications listed for any of these. The second agent on the market was nivolumab, which is Opdivo that is manufactured by Bristol-Myers Squibb. And the third agent is atezolizumab, Tecentriq by Genentech. I do not have the brand new indication of the non-small cell lung cancer that was released by the FDA today. So that is missing from this indication slide. And I think probably this kind of sets the stage for it's going to be the race for who gets the indication for the first line at this point. So kind of hold your checkbooks for a little while. I'm sure they're getting the hit already. And really that kind of brings into of some of the things that we have at the James, that we've seen at the James, we have a really robust off-label policy at the James. And ironically, the first request to use pembrolizumab was for an off-label indication. It's not an all-inclusive list. We actually have a program. We have a homegrown program I'll talk a little bit about later. But this is just some of the uses that we've seen for the various agents across the market. And I think I would be remiss of not talking about patient demand with this. Marketing has played a big role. You can't watch the nightly news or any evening program without seeing some type of PD-1 marketing. And it's actually been really great as far as these agents. We've had patients that have been on these agents since they first come out that are still on these agents. So they really have been able to bring that feeling of hope and optimism. And when you have someone famous like, you know, President Carter that has such a success story with these agents too, it increases your demand for your first line therapies for patients that are coming in and saying, I don't care how much it costs, I want to make sure that I'm getting this medication. A picture is worth a thousand words. We've been tracking the usage of our PD-1s at the James. Initially, it was actually tracking on each individual, like if we were getting paid for each individual ones. As you can see, I can't keep up with that now. The number of dispenses is increasing, and we kind of try to keep an eye on that as well as for one reason or another, and we'll kind of go through that of ways to make sure you're getting paid for this. Now, I'd like to take the spots. I think this time to talk about how our payers are looking at the IO agents. To say that there's a microscope around each one of these is quite accurate. They are they're getting a lot of attention from our payers. The first, with when we talk about any insurance, initially we're going to talk about original Medicare first. Most of the administrative contractors, the Medicare administrative contractors, or our MACs, have at least one local coverage decision that is out. In Ohio, we have single governmental services. They actually have an LCD for all three. We've been able to expand some of the LCD indications outside of the FDA label. But we've not been able to have any successful reimbursement outside of that LCD. We've actually seen denials on dosing from original Medicare, so that is something that your practices need to make sure that you look. It actually was not for these patients that they questioned. They were MUE edits. If you're familiar with what those are, they're saying, hey, wait a minute, this falls outside what a typical dose would be. And In these cases, we were using proper dosing, just the patient was a little beefy. So that's one of the things that we've had two patients that's come up for multiple months and actually had to write. It's a pretty easy appeal to write. Currently, there is no national coverage decision, which is fortuitous for us. I'd like to switch gears a little bit and kind of talk about our commercial payer response. This also includes our Medicare Advantage plans. Really, when we start to talk about commercial payers, probably the first line of defense for these patients, it's kind of auspicious when it starts to thunder and in the middle. I brought up commercial payers and it started, I was going to say. Sorry. But really, the first line of defense for our commercial payers are pathways and clinical guidelines. Some clinical guidelines, really, they can be as short as 3 or 4 sentences. Others can be, you know, anywhere from 10 to 14 pages. There are, and I will say that the other thing with clinical policies, you need to be very detail-oriented when looking at that. There are some payers that will go above what the FDA label or what the initial study has indicated. It may be like a caveat in something that maybe was an exclusion piece in an initial trial. So Anthem has picked up on the ECOG score. And so this is one of the ways that they can actually look at your patients. Let's say they had an ED visit and then they're due to get their nivolumab 2 weeks later. They'll actually send it back for, they want you to prove that patient didn't have the ECOG score, or they did have an ECOG score between 0 and 2 before they're going to pay you for this infusion. So those are the little things that you need to make sure that you're picking up on for your staff. Maximum dosing, this kind of comes into play. We've seen this with IO agents, not in PD-1s currently, but for ipilimumab, that they'll actually put in the maximum dose, which you can do. Now, when you live in Central Ohio, that's the other. We kind of grow them a little big. So there are times that we have folks that are obese that come in. We need to make sure that we are reaching out and actually have to do a predetermination to some of these payers to ensure that we're going to get paid. But you need to be aware of this because they don't call them maximum dose. They may call them frequency edits. And so you need to be aware of what this is. My new favorite authorization technique, and there's a few payers around the country that do use this authorization mechanism, is through NDC units versus HCPCS codes. Now, HCPCS codes are they take the volume of what, you know, we infuse in the pharmacy, and it gets transferred to milligrams. And that's I think pretty much everyone is familiar with that. That's how we bill. It's a standard practice across the country. Now, HCPCS, or the NDC units, kind of goes backwards. They use it in a volume of measure. There is crosswalks that are available. It's really confusing. So you have to make sure that, and actually demand from those payers, that they're giving you that crosswalk. They're telling you, okay, you know, 3 NDC units equals 250 milligrams. There's lots of things. I had one of my nurses has spent days and days and days of trying to figure this process out. And we really went back to the payer and asked them, they said, you need to tell us what this equates to, because you, and then on the opposite side, you also have to monitor for underpayment as well. They have a tendency, their billing folks don't understand that three NDC units, they're thinking three NDC units equates to 3 milligrams. And so that's the other thing of making sure that you're following those various things for underpayment. The disproportional approvals over a period of time. Now, this can happen where, you know, most folks will say, hey, we have an authorization between January 1st and March 30th. But you need to make sure that you have the certain number of doses. They'll also give you six, when I say they, the payer will give you, here's the number of infusions that we'll give you, here's the date range. You need to make sure they match, because many times they don't. And if you miss that and your date range is longer than the number of infusions, then you're dealing with denials for no authorization. If you actually, we see this as well for retrospective denials. If we have, if we've been given a predetermination approval for that an off-label indication, the payer many times will come back and challenge that authorization and give us a denial and a retrospective denial. It's nice of being able to, you keep that packet and you keep that information, and it helps to have everything all in one place. But you do need to monitor those off-label indications, even if you have approvals. Probably last but not least was when we start to talk about billing for waste. This is with IO agents, they are single dose vials, so they are eligible for billing for waste. I think with nivolumab's new change in their dosing, that actually has decreased the amount of that you have to focus on that. So really the big agent that we do that with would be pembrolizumab. You just need to ensure that if you are billing for waste, you are billing and using the JW modifier properly. Not all payers do pay you for waste. So most managed Medicaid plans will not pay you for waste. So some commercial plans will. Some of them don't recognize the JW modifier. And then you have to go back and do some education with those folks as well and provide them with their policies of how they pay for waste. Probably the other big piece is to make sure that you're ensuring you're using documentation for the JW modifier on those lines as far as somewhere in your medical record. If you have the Epic platform, they actually, on their upgrade, they have a way of when you bill for waste, you can actually put a pre-built line in that actually shows, so it makes it really easy peasy. If not, make sure that you have some place in the medical record that shows why did you bill for waste, just because you had a single dose vial. Now that we've talked about the products or the payers, I'd like to actually, we've set the kind of the stage on how do we do this at the James for IO agents, and it includes our other high dollar agents as well, but for this purpose we're going to kind of talk about the IO agents. Kind of back to my model a little bit, but really going to focus in on our reimbursement specialist and how they do this. And when we talk about predetermination and the off-dollar, high-dollar, so I have two FTEs that do this, and the IO agents fall into their workload. The reimbursement specialist is, I will say, kind of a unique position. Typically, we want someone that has a clinical background, but they're a savvy self-starter, someone who's super organized. They can navigate both the clinical terrain as well as the payer, you know, kind of those payer landmines along the way, and they have the ability to kind of exist into both. And I think it's a really special person that can kind of do that. I'm very fortunate to have also one of my reimbursement specialists, actually her first role in life was a journalist. So before she became an oncology nurse, and so she writes a mean denial letter, I tell you. So, I mean, she says some good things that she'll be able to do that. But they have the ability, because they're on the phone, they're pulling up clinical information, they're traversing, you know, they really are kind of behind the scenes, but they really do advocate for that patient on the front end. When we talk about, like, our pre-certification, those folks that you need to make sure that you're getting notification to the your reimbursement specialist or whoever is doing your prior authorizations in an organized fashion. Whether you have you can utilize that and leverage your EMR. We have Epic at Ohio State, and we've actually leveraged our EMR to build a work queue that there are predetermined markers that actually will populate based on drug, based on insurance, based on once that authorization is there, communicates that out to the infusion pharmacist to let them know that there is an authorization in place. And if not, then they're communicating back to that insurance, our reimbursement specialist. That also actually changes when the dose changes, the patient's insurance changes. Another drug is added to the medication, and it will populate that work queue based on, and we have them separated out based on if they're a high dollar medication or if they're a standard of care medication. So within pre-certification, that when you have whoever is doing your prior authorizations, there are probably some really key functions that they need to make sure that they are aware of. We talked about those clinical policies, and they need to know where to find those, and as well as the agents that they work with. Kind of, they get to know those pretty well. Of like, no, wait a minute, you know, nivolumab isn't, there's not for, you know, Highmark of West Virginia. They don't have a clinical policy, but there is one for Highmark of Pennsylvania, or for Anthem, or Aetna. And they need to know where to go find those. Where do they find the compendias, and what does it mean for those levels of evidence? What does that mean when you're talking to the payer, the third-party administrator for those? And then also for evidence-based guidelines. I think NCCN, really, when we talk with cancer care, it's the gold standard. We can bring in peer-reviewed literature for other things, and I think that's one of the one of our main probably cruxes is using NCCN so our prior authorization folks and our reimbursement specialists understand that these are the level of evidence that we need to have. Now, each one of these companies have different forms, different websites, different things of how to enter this information into their system. And yes, they actually do have written forms that you have to fill out. We're in a day and age, you would think that they would all have some type of portal you could put the information in, upload the clinical information, and away you go. No, unfortunately, some of them still have forms that you have to print out, fill out, fax in. And so you need to make sure they're legible. That's probably, so if someone has, you know, the handwriting that kind of is like my third grader, it won't cut it. But, you know, probably the other really big important thing that I think is key with especially when you're working with these third-party administrators, is building relationships with them. I'm not saying you have to invite them to Thanksgiving dinner. Not at all. But what you actually need to make sure that you're courteous and kind to them, ask them about their day. Because lots of times then they're like, oh, they're not going to yell at me. Oh, they're not going to, you know, and they'll engage because this will come back in and play later when they're needing other clinical information. They understand what level of you know, documentation that you provide, but then also too, they'll be like, you know, I'm not really supposed to do this, but let me get you in touch with the person that you need to talk to. So I think I always say kill them with kindness, and sometimes that goes a long way. I think I have this in a couple different spots in this presentation. Keep a copy of your authorization. Keep it in your medical record, keep it in a file, but keep a copy of your authorization, and don't expect that someone else is going to do that. Make sure those PA folks or your reimbursement specialists are keeping a copy of it. It will come in handy. Now, I will say a good sketch is better than a long speech, and I wanted to include our high dollar process at the James, and so I'm just going to go to the picture. We have about 15 or 16 agents that we do for the high dollar process, but the IO agents, probably this is one of the things that I was really passionate when we started with pembrolizumab at the James and then quickly nivolumab afterwards, that we needed to make sure that we figured out, did a comprehensive, you know, search on the patient's benefit, ensured that they had the ability to pay for those copays, and it's really helped when the insurance has denied they're not going to cover that we already have them enrolled in the pharmaceutical program. It really helps to benefit at expediting, you know, getting that patient either an appeal done or enrolled into the PAP program. So you can kind of read through this. I know it's one of those, I have a lot of material that we're going to talk about, but I really did not want to, like, leave this out because I think it's really important to add. Now, predetermination, we use predetermination, and so currently with Tecentriq, we are using this method because a lot of the payers don't have a clinical policy in place. We also use it for any of our off-label indications. But it is predetermination that when we have a way to make, when we're asking for this, we have to make sure that there is a way that is clear, traceable, communicating between our treatment teams and our reimbursement specialists, and having an ability to document that. It really is, we use at the James a homegrown database, and the gentleman that developed it is actually retiring at the end of the year. So I'm a little sad because we have to figure out somebody to actually support it for us. But we have the ability to track this information from when it's entered, when it's approved, when it's denied, and then we follow that out until the patient's done with their therapy. And you may, if you're not familiar with what a predetermination is, there's prior authorizations. And prior authorizations usually are for those things that are on label, standard of care. Predetermination is for when you're doing an appeal on the front end. You're going to the payer and you're saying, hey, we realize this is off label. This is outside of your guidelines. But here's my compelling story of why I want to use this. Here's the patient's clinical background, their labs, peer-reviewed literature, you know, if there's any, how this drug, you know, mechanically, that mechanism of action, how it works well with the genetic testing that's been done on this patient, and writing that compelling story. So we can include all that, send it in a packet, and send it off to our payers. So when, and probably this is the other thing, of when you send this into the payer, you need to be very clear, because when you're talking to, and sometimes you're talking to folks, unfortunately it's a representative that has to yet transfer you to that clinical nurse on the other side, you have to get through that first person and say, no, it's off label, we need a predetermination, or a complementary predetermination. Getting through to those clinical folks sometimes is, you feel like it's kind of the back door, and this is where your relationship that you've built with some of those TPAs comes in very handy, because, oh, I know Dr. Jones, who is the medical director here, he's, you know, he may take this into consideration, or we can go back to the treatment team and say, you're going to have to do a peer-to-peer with this, we're pretty certain, but we can get this set up for you. And so that's where starting, you know, killing him with kindness, it comes back. But there are different requirements. We've run into some payers that do have certain levels of literature support that they will require. So somewhere up to, we've recently had one that actually asked for 2 phase 3 trials. And it was like, whoa, you know, that's a first one. Usually it's 2 phase 2 and 1 phase 3 or some type of compendia support. And or if it's a rare disease and if we have, we can kind of make that stretch. But, you know, they will call them different things. But there again, there's the second part. Keep copies of your authorizations once you have that done. If they actually say, hey, we're going to put this in the mail, call back, ask another representative if they can fax it to you. And so that's the other piece. When they say they're going to get it in the mail, you may or may not get it, or it may go to kind of, if you have a lockbox where your payment goes to, it sometimes goes there. So then keeping track of who you talk to, when you talk to, that authorization number. Probably last, one of the big things is making sure, ensuring you're getting paid for these other IO agents. Common reasons for denials, notice that there's a couple stars here. Lack of pre-certification and timely filing of claims and or denials. These are things you can control. Your facility can control this, because if you don't get the authorization and it requires authorization, there's no really retrospective for most plans of going back and asking for forgiveness. You can beg for it, but they're really not going to give it to you. The other pieces are things that probably medical necessity and experimental investigational, those are probably your other two big ones. Others are bits and pieces of things that sometimes that you need to monitor for trends. Because if you start to see those things outside of experimental, investigational, and medical necessity, and they're starting to see them requiring additional information, and if you're starting to see that on a pretty regular basis, do we need to change our process on the front end and provide more information, or are we already providing that and they're just not looking at that information and they're playing a game, which many times it's the game. And so if you call them on the carpet of what's happening. Probably the other thing with denials, you know, if your folks and your reimbursement specialists, your prior authorization folks are submitting that clinical information, if there's the same people that are doing denials, and in our case, we needed to make sure that that got back to us in a timely fashion, that we didn't have 10 days to write a denial. And you have a 60-day window, and all of a sudden we have 10 days left to make sure that denial gets out the door. That's not acceptable. And so really, I really worked hard with our finance and our rev cycle team to ensure that we're getting that information in a timely fashion so it gives us time of being able to mount a defense against those denials. You need to make sure that you have adequate resources for the employees that you have. If you have 100 denials sitting in your queue and you only have half an FTE doing that, that's not adequate resources of being able to do that. One FTE for 100 is questionable. And they are denying, payers are denying for a lot of things. And it's usually, right now, it's a dollar threshold of what we're seeing. Anything above $50,000 and Anthem will deny it. That's one of the things. If your claim amount and your drop charge is $50,000, you'll expect to see that denial come back into your work queue. Making sure your folks are trained adequately, they know where to get their information. I think that's always super important to do that. Then there again, talking about monitoring for trends, elevating those trends to your managed care team, to your rev cycle folks. And if you can't get that resolved and working with the payers one-on-one, elevate that then to your governmental affairs folks. It is vitally important to make sure that you hold the payers responsible for contractually, their contractual portion of this. There again, your house needs to be in order as well. And that's usually the first question that I always ask is like, if we're doing something wrong, I want to make sure that we're making sure my people are doing this properly. And usually that comes back with some silence. Because usually we're following the procedure that they want us to follow, but something has fallen off on that other end. And I think that one of those, as we start to see consolidations of various payers and we get to that big three, they're getting bigger and bigger and things get lost in translation. Outdated payer policies, and I'm not sure if any of you have looked at some of these payer policies. Actually, I was looking at the nivolumab policy with one of our residents this last week, and the last time it was updated was May of 2016, so the flat dose dosing for the three indications aren't even there. They still have weight-based dosing. It's okay for those patients that are above 240 that would be, but for those patients that we need to round up to the 240, it does create an issue. We've had payers that have had when they're maybe a year and a half behind, and so then you have to challenge and go through. And finally, usually it's talking to a clinical person that says, hey, can you please, here's the FDA label, will you please look at this? And usually that's with a new indication. So like when the indication came across for Tecentriq today, it went to my reimbursement specialist, and they'll send that letter from the FDA along with any requests that come out until some type of clinical policy can be updated. I think you've gotten my message about holding your payers accountable. I think that's one of the things that they will too. You'll see them come back and say, oh, we didn't have pre-certification. And you're like, nope, I have my letter of pre-certification right here that we got from your third-party administrator, but the third-party administrator didn't get that information over to you. We are having a challenge with Aetna currently with this. They are notorious for giving us they'll come back with that, it's a 197 denial of lack of pre-certification. And so it's denied for that, and it's basically a really easy appeal to write because you provide that authorization and then you go forward. So if that trend becomes high, you need to make sure that, especially if you're doing everything appropriately, or my other is when they don't require prior authorization, and then they'll say, okay, as of March of 2016, vaccine, you know, we need to make sure that this has prior authorization. And then they start to deny January and February, saying lack of authorization. You can pull out that medical policy that says authorization is required on 3-1 of 2016 and not on January and February. So you just have to play and be detail-oriented with them. When this is always a challenge when payer policies are going to lag behind the FDA, and we kind of talked about that, making sure that you have those policies, they have the label changes, if any compendia support is updated, making sure that you have that as quick as possible. And really, you can't go back and ask for retro authorization. It's pretty rare that you can do that. There are very few payers now that will let you go back and throw yourself on the sword, unless they have made kind of, we talked about that NDC unit. We've had that kind of happen where I've talked with the pharmacy director at the one insurance company that we deal with, and I'm sure when she sees my email come across, she kind of cringes, because I'm like, we have a new scenario, we've been able to work with them to say, yeah, you know, we should have made sure that this was done correctly. But I think when any time you have a new agent that comes into play, expect to have more resources devoted to this until it's in the system at least 6 months. So that it's just going to take a little bit more time. With new, and I'm not sure of like how much that you know about when a new drug comes out, it actually gets an unassigned code. And with a biologic agent, if you bill on a UB04, you use a C9399 agent billing code, and then you have to send the NDC number, then units of use, and it's actually a one unit, but it actually goes in a special spot in your UB04. And if you're a physician practice or like a physician clinic, you'd use that J999 code for an unassigned biologic. Temporary codes are actually sometimes more problematic than your unassigned codes, because a lot of the payers, they can't get that equated into their system. So then you start to bill that temporary code after so nivolumab is a great example. Nivolumab, Pembro, like we're running into this with actually a lot of the new agents that have come out. But it had 6 months, it had that unassigned C9399 code from, what was it, July to January, it had that a temporary code. We've actually seen more denials with those temporary codes than we did with the C9399. We were basically like, no, look, it's the exact same, and had to say, no, it's the same NDC number, it's the same coding, here's what CMS has required us to do. And then when it becomes a new code, then you have to make sure that your authorization matches that new code when the new code comes out. So it is being very mindful of that. I get a monthly report that I follow, you know, really for every C9399 agent that we use at the James, as well as our temporary codes. And if there's issues with that billing and we have authorizations, we elevate that up to our rev cycle team, as well as our managed care if we can't get it resolved with our rev cycle folks. So being diligent is probably the best thing that we can do. Tips of making sure when you work with your payers, they all will put out some type of bulletin, newsletter that they're going to communicate when authorizations of new drugs, when they need authorizations, we talked about those frequency edits. They're going to put the information in there, but it may not always be like front and center. It may be kind of buried within the different things. I have been able to work with our managed care team that when they have quarterly meetings with all of our payers, I'm able to sit in that, and one of the standing questions are, you know, are there any new pharmacy authorization, you know, medications that we need to be aware about? And we've brought various things to them, especially if seeing it a trend and bringing it at the meeting, especially when it has a high dollar price tag that goes along with it. I also have one of my reimbursement specialists that is, she's kind of assigned to making sure that everyone in the office understands any new authorizations or things that kind of come along to play. probably final things of making sure we'll wrap up here pretty quick, of how do you keep up with your the payer's ability to keep up with new indications, new lines of therapy, combination therapies? I think that's kind of the new thing of at the James, we have a lot of trials that are coming out as far as with, I kind of shudder to see all of the PD-1 trials that are open currently, because I know that that's going to come to practice here, or a portion of those are going to come out in the practice, and a lot of them are with combination agents. And then the other is that race to be first line. It's coming, so I will probably see that. I would think in the next anywhere from 1 to 3 quarters, depending on you know what the FDA does. So with that, I'll entertain any questions. Yes.
Could you kind of quickly outline how you have people set up their own model units? Who supervises what?
Yep. So I actually. Yeah, so I kind of have a lead person that I was going to say the nurse that actually has the, we kind of stole her from our, we brought this resource into pharmacy about 2 years ago and have expanded it to those 6 FTEs and do all of the authorizations. They report through me, so I kind of oversee and make sure of like if they're hitting their work cues. We have a productivity model for them of how they hit. Mm-hmm. Yes. And so it is a nice model in that the authorization, that everything is contained. They know who to call. Authorization for our retail specialty pharmacy, that does not report to me, thankfully. But it is also within pharmacy that, you know, it's kind of, we try to make sure that we're communicating similarly out to especially our clinical staff, nursing staff, the folks that are sending those referrals into us. Yes.
So just the one thing that I wanted to add, because I think it's a really important part of this wonderful program, so the pharmacists on the front line really work closely with these folks, the reimbursement specialists. I think what we decided to do was put a face with a name so that they knew who these pharmacists were that they're talking to. They were actually arranged for them to want to onboard with the different pharmacists so they knew which diseases they'd be working with. So the clinical component of this can't be understated, because I mean, even some of them are oncology nurses, but having them get to know the pharmacists and from there get to know the advanced providers and the physicians has really made this process so much smoother. I remember physicians used to get things just even in their inbox and hope somebody else would take care of it for them. And so now they know directly through the pharmacist, and often the pharmacist can facilitate the discussion. So it makes a big difference.
But those it tends to be nurses that
are
having to, you know, versus pharmacy tends to.
Right. And that's one of the things of, there's sometimes, I mean, you end up with, you know, the statements of, you know, we're the pharmacy police or the, I mean, and I think that regardless of if you ever have somebody that puts the brakes on things, it is, you do get a little bit of pushback, but they really have learned to, you know, have that dialogue and be open and holding the prescribers accountable for, you know, when they have to do a peer-to-peer, when we need them to get involved. And that's our biggest goal.
Thanks, Sarah. Thank you.
Thank you.
So much.